Hello, you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI. This is Cowtown Conversations, and I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. And today, we are going to have a doctor with us, and we're going to talk about something that will impact a lot of people. She is Dr. Devika Malik, if I'm correct. She's a maternal and fetal OBGYN doctor, and she is trained to work with patients who may have complications during pregnancy or high-risk pregnancies. Good morning, Dr. Devika. Welcome to Cowtown Conversations.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So can you tell us, listeners, a little bit about yourself? Are you originally from the Kansas City metropolitan area?
Well, I've been all over. I was born in upstate New York, and then I spent most of my formative years growing up in Kansas City. And I loved Kansas City. And then I did high school in New York. I was in the East Coast for a while. I went to medical school at Cornell, New York City, did my residency at UCLA, and then I came back, did my high-risk pregnancy fellowship here at UMKC.
So you graduated from one of the premier high-risk pregnancy colleges in the nation. If I get it correct, it is the Wheelie Clinic?
The Weill College.
Weill College. So what inspired you to go there?
Well, I was in the East Coast at the time, so I had done college there, and my family was there, and so it was the natural gravitation was to stay in New York City. I loved the diversity of the city, and then I had the opportunity to go to the West Coast, which I'd never been to, never lived in, so I got to live there. But when I was in the West Coast, my parents moved back to Kansas City, so we always were very fond of our community here, and so I came back, to join them after I was done with my obstetric training.
So what inspired you to become an OBGYN physician and work with women who are pregnant?
That's a good question. Well, the funny thing is that my father is also a high-risk pregnancy specialist, so a lot of people think I just followed his footsteps, but I really tried hard not to do that. So I think, honestly, I went to an all-women's college, Wellesley College, and I was actually a literature major, but I did pre-med requirements, and a lot of the people that I did pre-med with ended up in OBGYN as well. And I think that we just had a lot of a sense of mission to really promote women's health and birthing people's health care.
So Dr. Malik, how long have you been practicing here?
Oh, gosh. I came here in 2012, so I've been here for over 10 years.
So, and you're not on staff at just one hospital. You're on staff at multiple hospitals here in the area.
Yeah, that's true. I've had the privilege of either having been or currently being at multiple hospitals. My primary place that I'm at is University Health. And I'm the high-risk pregnancy fellowship director for UMKC, but I also work at Advent Health Shawnee Mission. I work at I work with the hospital at University Health at Lee Summit at Lakewood. I also had previously had a clinic at Olathe at Children's Mercy Hospital as well. I previously was faculty at KU, so I pride myself in knowing all the different docs all over the city area.
You are a very busy woman, one who's probably very high in demand.
Well, it's a privilege to be high in demand, but yes, it is. It's a wonderful job to have, and it's a wonderful community to serve.
Dr. Malik, pregnancy is a happy time for those who are expecting, both the mother and the father. Why is it critical for every woman to receive proper medical care during their pregnancy?
Well, pregnancy is a really wonderful time, but it is also one that is can bring a lot of complications. And complications for a family that's about to grow can feel incredibly overwhelming. And when you find the early signs of those complications, it can help manage it and make it feel a little bit more makes it feel less overwhelming.
Why is it critical to have someone such as yourself either on your team or your doctor has access to that person? Being one of my children was high risk, and so I went through that entire gambit, and there's nothing I've been in two combat zones. I've completed a lot of other things. Nothing compares you for when they say high risk. So why is it important to be able to have that person on your team if you're in a high-risk pregnancy?
That's a great question. Well, first, I love how you focus at that, those words, high risk, just how, you know, they hold a certain power. And I, whenever patients come to me, they're like, oh, I'm high risk. And I always say, no. You know, yes, sometimes they are genuinely high risk, but sometimes it's just a matter of trying to be preventive and trying to plan if anything goes wrong, what are the next steps, so that when we do, if we do get to that point, it's not so, as I said, overwhelming. But it's important that a doctor has access, a doctor has access to a high-risk doctor if they're not high-risk specialists themselves, because sometimes we don't know everything, and sometimes it's not really necessarily in their scope of training to take care or to deal with these complications. So when you get to a point where you're dealing with these complications, it's nice to have a specialist who can pretty much, like, you know, steer the ship into a place where it's a little bit safer, or where you can really spend time with the patients. I think that's one of the wonderful things about my specialty, is that we really spend a lot of time talking to people about what can go wrong and really trying to, you know, calm them down and say, like, you know, we're a team together. We're going to do this together. You're not alone.
And those are things that you definitely want to hear at that particular point. But as in the military, it's about having a plan and making a plan.
Right.
Because my military training kicked in. I'm like, okay, well, this is a thing. So where are we at? What are the options? What are the things we need to look for? It's about being informed and engaged, but also knowing that you've got that doctor to help you make that plan at that particular point.
Right, right.
So, Dr. Malik, many women are waiting to start a family, and now some are, you know, 33, 34, and also, you know, 35 and older, and those are ages usually when women may have stopped having children. Does being older and starting a family make it a high-risk pregnancy?
That's a great question. I don't think it automatically makes it a high-risk pregnancy, and I think most of my colleagues would agree with me. I think after a certain age, there's a higher risk for complications to happen, but the odds are that you're probably going to have a normal pregnancy. But it's important to be prepared for those complications if they do arise. So I do believe that, you know, you have to have a little bit more specialized prenatal care when you're, you know, above a certain age. But I always tell my patients who are a little bit older and a little bit nervous about, you know, getting pregnant, and, you know, they're like, oh my gosh, I'm high risk and everything's going to go wrong. And I was like, no, actually the odds are everything is going to be just fine. But there is a slightly higher chance that it can happen. And if it does, that you should, you know, be in conversation with your high risk doctor. And sometimes it's better to do that before anything happens, so that you know who's your team when something does happen.
Dr. Malik, how many weeks is a normal pregnancy?
Well, it's 40 weeks is what we usually say. But, you know, I always say that the estimated date of delivery is like a moving target. Like, I always say all bets are off after 35 weeks. And, you know, you never know if anything's going to happen before. So.
And you can kind of tell if your child comes early, all the target stones will hit early. if your child comes late, they're not going to be motivated to do anything. I'm like, I'll get to it when I get to it. So you kind of figure it out. So, Dr. Monique, how often should a woman see a doctor when she's pregnant?
Well, usually it starts every month that you should see your OBGYN, not necessarily your high-risk specialist. And then it gets around towards the end of the second trimester, in the early third trimester, every 2 weeks, and then weekly. But it really depends how the pregnancy is going. I mean, that's just a overall plan, but every pregnancy is different, and if you're a little bit more complicated, you may have to see the doctor very frequently. I see a lot of my patients who I manage their diabetes. I have the privilege of getting to talk to them almost every week, so we become really close by the end.
And you're getting to this is going to be interesting now. You're getting to a lot of things that we're going to definitely talk about.
Okay.
So, Dr. Malik, some women may become pregnant and have pre-existing conditions that can make the pregnancy even more difficult. You know, diabetic, having lupus, or other medical conditions. How critical is it that they let their doctor know that they have pre-existing medical conditions that could be a complication within the pregnancy?
Oh, it's critical. You know, I would argue, and I think many people would say, that one of the most important times of the pregnancy is actually the time before you're pregnant, because oftentimes we don't know we're pregnant, and then when we do know it, a lot of things that have happened with the pregnancy or has been determined what's going to happen with the pregnancy has already been determined. In fact, like, we believe that people who develop high blood pressure in pregnancy, or, you know, if they have problems with the placenta, that's already getting somewhat determined in that time where you don't know you're pregnant. So knowing what are the potential complications that you have that could contribute to your pregnancy health, it's good to talk to a doctor before you even get pregnant.
So there are, as you said, there's a lot of different things that you can do and you don't know at that point in time. So the term high-risk pregnancy, people throw it out there, but what does it actually mean and how concerned should we be?
I mean, it is a blanket statement, and it covers a whole spectrum of severity in terms of what you, some of it is you have a high probability of a high-risk pregnancy, and some of it is you're actually a high-risk pregnancy. And so I always have to tell people that there's a difference between that. There's, you know, like, for example, with the older moms, there's some probability they'll have a high-risk pregnancy, but it doesn't mean they are high-risk. And so I think regardless, it's always good to talk to a high-risk pregnancy doctor. But if you have anything like diabetes, high blood pressure, if you have lupus that, you know, requires a lot of management, these are things that can sometimes automatically make your pregnancy high risk, especially because pregnancy puts a lot of pressure on your body. You're growing a human being. It's absolutely amazing. But if your body is already under a lot of stress, that stress can be exacerbated by the pregnancy and can also have an impact on the pregnancy health and the fetal health of the baby.
So how does high blood pressure impact a pregnancy?
So what I love to say, well, I'll tell you a funny story first, is that I remember my mom was really into the Twilight series, all those vampires. And she was telling me about how those books dealt with pregnancy. And she said, you know, the babies there, they feed on blood. And I had to tell my mom, I was like, well, so do normal human pregnancies. You know, we develop, you know, in the sac, in the balloon of fluid. And we have a placenta. And the placenta is an incredibly important organ. And the placenta is nothing but blood vessels and circulation. And what I always like to say is that when we talk about blood pressure, it is a disease of circulation, or it is a problem with circulation, in that you're having a lot of, the blood is flowing against an incredible amount of resistance. So that can impact the placenta too when you grow a placenta, and can affect the blood flow to the baby. And so sometimes the baby can grow smaller, but also there are things that are more subtle that can happen with the placenta where it could predispose you to developing preeclampsia. We say that moms who have high blood pressure have a 30% chance of developing preeclampsia. It can be as high in certain communities as 60%.
And you work with University Health, and a lot of these are the same health concerns that minorities see: high blood pressure, diabetes. You know, how important is it that if a woman who's definitely a minority who's susceptible to these type of health concerns be on board and see it, getting that adequate prenatal care?
Oh, I think it's very important. But I would like to say that, like, some of that is, like, yes, going to go to the hospitals and going to the clinic. And some of that is, you know, also there's a lot of incredible community resources to also help navigate it. A lot of women have found that, you know, finding other people who have experienced it or have friends who have experienced this has been a great resource. But it is very important to talk to, you know, a healthcare provider about your complications, your health complications, or the risks of it. You know, when you see your family, you can already tell what you're at risk for. You know, diabetes runs in my family as well. High blood pressure runs in my family as well. And it's something that every year you should be taking a look at and trying to be proactive about. What I tell patients when they have high blood pressure and diabetes in the pregnancy, I said, you're at risk in your life of having these things develop. But the good news is that the earlier you find it, the more you can control it.
So if a woman is looking at having children, you know, what are things that she should be, you know, okay, diabetes, starting to look at, you know, if maybe getting checking to see how her blood pressure is running.
Right.
Other things. What are things that a woman really needs to look at when she's looking at having a child that may seem normal, but once you grow in that human, become a little bit of a complication.
Well, I think it's important that she speaks to her healthcare provider earlier than later, as we sort of talked about, that she talks to a high-risk doctor. If she wants to talk to a high-risk doctor, maybe she is not obviously somebody who's high-risk but is nervous about those things. I'm always available to talk to. I think any doctor is available to talk to somebody about that. And I think it's important to note that there's a lot of early interventions that can actually very strongly impact the pregnancy. One of them for high blood pressure is taking aspirin early in the pregnancy. It's a fairly recent thing that we've done. I always say it's 5 years ago, but I think it's now 10 years ago. The U.S. Preventative Task Force recommended that anybody who's a little bit high risk for developing preeclampsia should be taking aspirin earlier in the pregnancy and through the pregnancy. And it's been shown to reduce the risk of developing preeclampsia by 24%. Some studies show even higher. It has also been shown to decrease the risk of preterm birth and perinatal mortality, you know, even the baby growing small. So it's one of these things where I say it's like the new prenatal vitamin. And the prenatal vitamin is also a very important thing to consider, because right now folic acid and folate is the only thing that we know. It's the only medication or anything. It's the only supplement that we know that can prevent congenital anomalies. And when I say congenital anomalies, that means babies that are born with, you know, problems with their heart structurally or problems with their body structurally. And so if you start those things early in the pregnancy, or in the case of vitamins, before the pregnancy, you can actually really have a strong impact on the health of the pregnancy.
So if a woman is maybe considering getting pregnant, start to take the prenatal vitamins before she's actually pregnant to build up the folic acid in her body.
Yes, exactly.
So, Dr. Malik, how does a high-risk pregnancy differ from a normal pregnancy?
So a high-risk pregnancy means that they may have some different needs, and it really varies depending on what is making the pregnancy high-risk. For diabetes, you have to make sure that your glucose is really, really tightly controlled. I have a friend who is a type 1 diabetic, and when I told her the kind of control that we need in pregnancy to have good, you know, to reduce the risk of stillbirth and reduce the risk of miscarriage, she was like, "Wow, that's pretty intense." And I think we recognize how intense it is, and that's why we make sure that we talk to our patients almost every week about how their sugars are, you know, what are the challenges. I also emphasize to them that some of their sugars are, yeah, some of it is what you eat, but a lot of it is just your placenta. As your placenta grows, it pushes out a lot of hormones that make you more insulin resistant, makes your sugars go high. So I always say them, this is not about like judging what you're eating. It's actually looking at what your pregnancy needs are.
And as a man who was convicted of eating the last piece of a pregnant woman's chocolate cake, which you never live down. You know, women can have some very difficult cravings and things during that time. What causes that?
That's a good question. I don't think an OBGYNs have a good answer for that. My husband joked that I had anti-cravings. I was like, I don't want that. I don't like that. I mean, there's some theory that there's like an evolutionary reason for that. That it actually made patients like eat things that were less likely to be causing food poisoning or issues like that, and you know, more likely to stay away from foods that can endanger the pregnancy. But I don't know. There's not a good explanation, because I see all sorts of cravings. Yeah, all sorts of cravings.
So the barbecue chips, pickles, bananas, and ice cream is a normal thing. Is that what you're trying to say?
Well, for some people it is. Not everybody. Some people don't like that. The pickles and the chips and the saltiness is something that you see everywhere. Even in India, they have like tamarind and things like that. I didn't really crave myself when I was pregnant. I didn't crave sour foods, but you see all sorts of cravings. Some people crave fruit. Some people crave, I hated pizza when I was pregnant. I can't explain it. And then you will be like, oh, maybe your son doesn't like pizza. My son loves pizza. He just didn't like it as a fetus.
So before he even got here, he was controlling what he was and wasn't going to eat.
Oh, he was a picky eater even in utero, yes.
He would let you know, I didn't like that.
Yeah, yeah. I actually, when I was in my first trimester, I had to go for a research conference in Italy, and I was just the worst. Like, I used to order food, and I couldn't eat it. And I remember somebody came to me and was like, "Do you not like the food?" And I was like, I'm pregnant, you know, and they were like, "Oh." They didn't understand, but it was really funny because I would order a whole dish and I'll be like, "I can't eat this."
So your eyes liked it, but your stomach was like, "No, we're not going to deal with that
today."
Yeah,
exactly.
Or you take that one bite and your son's like, "Nah, they kick to show their approval and disapproval at that particular point."
Yeah, exactly.
So the We Clinic, many people may not know that the vision of maternal and fraternal medicine, the We Clinic, is one of the top medical facilities, as I said, in the United States, an international leader in comprehensive care for high-risk pregnancies. What do you talk there that makes you all so much better and have a good idea, especially in the minority community where we have a lot of women who may end up in high-risk pregnancies? That what are they teaching that gives you all that edge up on other doctors and different things that may not go there?
I don't know if it was, I don't know if like necessarily, I think I had a good education. I had an education in a different part of the country, but I think everybody has really interesting education. I think training in New York, the great thing was that you worked with an incredibly diverse community. And I also had the privilege of working in a medical school that used gynecologic teaching assistants or associates, sorry, is teaching associates. And I just learned this recently from this wonderful, wonderful documentary called At Your Cervix, that where they're basically these teaching associates who are, you know, come and they essentially allow medical students to practice how to do a thoughtful, you know, consenting pelvic exam. So that was one of the really one of the great things that I just thought every medical school does, and I learned later that not every medical school does necessarily. So I think I learned to work with a very diverse community in a very thoughtful way. And I always learned very early on, I think this is just when a lot of those consent legislations were coming out, that that you have to do things in a very, you know, mindful of what the patient is feeling and in their history.
So if a patient has been pregnant, but that pregnancy was, say, even though it was a stillborn or a miscarriage, does that make them higher risk when they go to get pregnant again?
Yes, it does. Miscarriage is very common, though. I will say that. It's not something that, even how common it is, doesn't make it easier. And I find that it's also not a thing that has gone easier to counsel a mom about. It's the only thing that I have found that has sometimes helped them is to let them know they're not alone. It's something that many women experience. I have experienced a miscarriage. And I think when they understand that, they realize that there's nothing wrong that they did. There's nothing wrong with them. It's an unfortunate just part of, you know, part of the journey of growing a family sometimes. But if they keep on having a miscarriage, then sometimes we want to like look at some blood tests and see if there's something that we can tweak to make sure that they have a successful pregnancy. Stillbirth is a different story. Stillbirth, if you have a stillbirth, that does put you at a higher risk of having a stillbirth with subsequent pregnancies, but it's not that high still. The odds are very much that you're most likely going to have a normal pregnancy and a live birth baby. But it is, you know, when a mom has a stillbirth, it is also a huge emotional, it's a huge emotional part of their journey with their next pregnancy. And that's something that they need the time and the patience to, you know, for their healthcare team to really to give them the time and the patience to deal with that. I always tell moms who have gone through stillbirths that they should never feel, they often are apologetic for how tearful they are or how anxious they are. And I'm just like, what you're experiencing is completely normal, you know, and that you should understand that anybody, most people who have gone through what you've gone through is, you know, this is how they deal with their subsequent pregnancies.
So does University Health offer counseling services, any type of services to women who maybe have went through something like that, and unfortunately to help them begin their process of healing?
Yeah, well, we definitely offer services for something called like preconceptional counseling. That basically means before you're getting pregnant or planning the pregnancy, you would like to know like what you could be doing differently before or during the pregnancy. So often they come to a high-risk doctor like me to talk about that. And the other thing is that when they're pregnant, sometimes I still have them come back to me just to talk about, see how they're doing. You know, we're not here just for the medical part of it, not just for like, oh, managing their sugars and managing their blood pressure, because I do think it's integrated to also their mental health and, you know, how they're processing all the rapid changes that happen with pregnancy.
And I know we are a nation of people who we love our McDonald's, we love the fried chicken, we love the different things which impacts the weight. How does being a little bit heavier impact a woman in pregnancy?
Well, we have some data, but you know, I think being heavier does increase a lot of the complications that can happen with the pregnancy. But I think what heavy actually means, we're still struggling to find a really good definition of what that is. And I do want to say that, like, you know, if you're heavier, you're higher risk of having high blood pressure or higher risk of having diabetes. But I think pregnancy is a great opportunity to actually work with a team to implement lifestyle changes and dietary changes. You know, you're seeing a doctor so often, and especially if you're diabetic, you're seeing your high-risk doctor incredibly often. And it's a great way to talk to somebody, you know, see what are the changes you can make. I mean, I'm usually the first person to tell my diabetic patients I would be a terrible gestational diabetic myself. And part of it is that we don't live in a society with an infrastructure that really promotes health, right? We don't have ability to really walk around. You know, when you go to a lot of countries that have urban planning around walking, you know, it's so much easier to walk and get those steps in. Where it's like, you know, when I usually come back from a vacation somewhere else, I have to struggle to get those steps in. And that's what I always tell patients. I was like, you work at it. I wish we lived in a infrastructure where you didn't have to work at it, that you had access to highly nutritionally dense food, and you had access to, you know, walking and physical activity. But you know, I also try to support them and help them and try to figure out ways, even within the limitations of our own society and our own community, how to, you know, how to work towards those goals.
I know when I was in Europe and Italy, the parking lot may be a good quarter mile.
Yeah.
Or it could be as, you know, as few as three or four blocks or a quarter mile from where you're going. There's no driving up to the market, right, and just parking in the market. No, you've got to walk to the market. Then you got to walk through the market.
Right.
And then you got to walk back to your car. So, you know, there's different places. It's way different in Europe than what it is in America.
Yeah.
That you can definitely... We want to drive up. We want the first slot in front of the door. We want to walk in, minimize, get what we get, right, and walk out. No, you folks, if you ever go overseas, be prepared for some walking, because there is not. You know, when I went to see the Leaning Tower in Pisa, uh-huh, there is a gate around the city. There's no cars allowed in the gate. So
right,
you're walking from the parking lot to that. Or if you were lucky, the bus would... They were controlling the smog and everything, so the bus would come up to a certain point, pick you up, and get you there, but you still had to walk, so it's a lot different than what people think.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Malik, some women are surprised to learn that they're not just having one baby. They may be having triplets, or they may be having twins. Does having multiple babies turn a normal pregnancy into a high-risk pregnancy?
Yeah, that does.
So that's going to check that box.
That will check that box. I mean, there's different kinds of twin pregnancy. We'll just focus on the twins. When they get higher than twins, that's definitely much more high risk. But when you have twins, sometimes they have their own unit. They have their own, you know, they have their own balloons they're in. They have their own placentas. And those are the least high risk. So I always say that's the one that you, if you're going to plan for a twin pregnancy, that's the one you want. But sometimes when they share the placenta, then it gets complicated and they need a lot of ultrasounds, and we need to, you know, watch how everything is going. But when you have twins when you have twins and extra placenta in there, you're at higher risk of developing gestational diabetes and extra risk of developing preeclampsia as well. There's a higher risk of preterm birth. So they, you definitely need to be talking to a high-risk doctor, but you don't necessarily need to be getting your primary obstetric care from them.
So we're going to take a short break. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI. This is Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. And today we're talking with Dr. Deliva Malik, who is the high-risk pregnancy doctor at University Health and a few other hospitals here in town. Stay tuned right back after this short break. So we're back. This is Joseph Jackson, hosting Cowtown Conversations on 90.1 FM, KKFI. And our host is Dr. Deliva Malik.
Deliva Malik.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's not an easy name.
Yeah, I'm trying. So you, many women may have pre-existing conditions such as fibroids. As I said, we talked earlier about diabetes. What do they need to know if they're pregnant? Especially, I know fibroids can be definitely a situation that can be a lot more different to deal with than some of the other things.
Yeah. Well, fibroids is very common. And sometimes mothers find out and birthing people find out they have fibroids when they're pregnant because they get an ultrasound and it was, you know, asymptomatic. In those cases, most of the time, it's really nothing to worry about. And I would say by and large, a fibroid uterus is not something that will turn a pregnancy automatically high risk. In rare cases, it can grow. And it can grow really rapidly to the point that it can cause significant pain. And in those situations, it is a high-risk pregnancy. You know, oftentimes the moms have to be in the hospital or in and out of the hospital getting pain management for that. But that's a really, really rare occurrence. The other thing is that we also want to make sure that the baby's growing well, because sometimes depending on how large the fibroid is or how much it impacts the growth of the baby or the placenta. We sometimes watch how the baby's growing with ultrasounds. And then at the time of delivery, there's a slightly higher chance of needing a C-section or having bleeding problems afterwards. But again, what I keep on saying is that just because you have a higher risk of it doesn't mean it's going to happen. And the odds are usually that everything will be fine.
And I know that preeclampsia, we talked about it, that was one of the things that happened with one of my children, preeclampsia. What is preeclampsia?
So that's a great question. Preeclampsia is essentially a reaction that your body is having to the pregnancy. And we don't really understand why it happens or how it happens exactly, but we know how it presents. It usually presents with high blood pressure. You can start getting swelling. You can also notice that your organs are stressed. You notice that your liver enzymes are higher. Your kidneys are also stressed. And in rare cases, it can cause seizures. It can also cause sometimes pulmonary edema. It can cause stress on the heart as well. And when we usually find it, sometimes you get preeclampsia that's not too bad. It's very mild. And in those cases, you know, we manage them. You know, we manage them actively, but we watch sometimes very closely and deliver at an appropriate gestational age. But if it gets really severe, like when we started talked about the organs getting affected, things like that, then it's something that can sometimes warrant delivering a baby early. And that can be pretty stressful for the family, also for the physicians too, but it can be pretty stressful for the family. But we're often dealing with a rock and a hard place at that point, which is, you know, do we really think that we can get more time for the baby to be inside, you know, but are we doing that at the detriment of a mother's life, you know? And the episode I never left, I always tell patients, like, don't watch Downton Abbey. I don't know if people still watch Downton Abbey, but there is an episode where one of the main characters develops preeclampsia, and it was before we had a lot of the interventions that we have right now. But it can be really, really overwhelming to develop preeclampsia and not really know what the end point is, because it really is like an hour by hour, day by day journey where we're just making sure that everything is safe. And when we get to a point where we think things are not safe, that we sometimes have to make the hard decision to deliver early.
At what point in time in a pregnancy does preeclampsia usually show itself?
So we say anytime after 20 weeks, but usually it happens in the third trimester, usually.
So is there, you know, are there some simple signs that a woman may know that she's having preeclampsia or something that, you know, this doesn't just seem quite right, but I can't put my finger on it, but something is wrong?
Yeah, that's exactly what I tell them to. If they ever feel a little bit off, they have a headache that's not going away even with medication, if they notice that their blood pressure is high and they don't really have a good explanation for it, those are the early signs that they may be developing preeclampsia. The other things are they may have risk factors for it. And so if they have risk factors for it, they should be watching for those anyway. If they had a prior pregnancy with preeclampsia, if they have high blood pressure, those things definitely predispose you to having it again.
And I know when my son was born, my wife at the time developed preeclampsia, and it was one of those things of when we were at the doctor's office, her blood pressure was high, and they just, you know, it's like, yeah. And when they went back and compared it to the thing, yeah, we may need to see you once, we'll see you weekly at this particular point in time. So what are strategies that if a woman develops preeclampsia that a doctor can do, that some things that she may be able to do at home?
Usually with preeclampsia, most of the time we manage it in the hospital just because it can get bad very quickly. There are some rare instances where we do very closely manage it as an outpatient, especially if, you know, it depends on the mom's or the birthing person's access to transportation, how severe it is, how worried we are. But most of the time we often keep our patients in the hospital. But I always tell all my patients that everything is a conversation. But sometimes if I really feel strongly that they have to be in the hospital, that, you know, that's what I tell them. But ultimately they can make the decision of what they feel. But it is one of these things where it can get bad really quickly, and it is best if they're in the hospital, because if they get bad really quickly, you're more likely to have a good outcome if you're by the team that can manage you really quickly.
So if a woman has pre-existing conditions, can that impact the development of the child?
Yeah, absolutely. So especially with diabetes, we know that if a mom doesn't have diabetes that is, you know, within range, that it can increase the risk of the baby having, you know, heart defects, can be having, you know, other problems in the body. We also know that's really the main one with diabetes. But we also know with, you know, when moms have other problems, that other medical problems, sometimes they also take medications that can impact that as well. For example, if moms have seizures and they're on seizure medications, there's a small chance that the baby can also have problems with the heart as well. That's the most common one. But so there's always a chance that health issues can have an impact on the pregnancy. And in situations where they're on medication but they need those medications, I always say it's a risk-benefit thing. You know, if they really need those medications to not have a seizure and, you know, and stay healthy, you know, the odds are the baby's going to be just fine and we'll just continue watching the pregnancy. If we get into a situation where there's a complication, you know, we'll talk about it early on so that when we, you know, if we do happen upon that complication, that there's a sense of like, okay, we knew this may happen and that, you know, these are the things that we're going to do.
Go back to having that plan in place.
And exactly.
Working the plan. And I will say this, I'll talk about it a little bit later. Sometimes there's parts of that plan that you are not prepared for, that when things happen. But yeah, when you determine that you're in a high risk pregnancy, and when I say you, that means there's two of you in there. There's a mother and a father in there. And that's a situation where teamwork makes the dream work, because you all both have to work together at that particular point in time. So the single is preeclampsia. Then we go to the double, which is, you've talked about already, gestational diabetes. What is gestational diabetes?
Oh, that's a great question. So there's the moms who already have diabetes and they get pregnant, and that's different from gestational diabetes. Gestational diabetes means that you develop high glucose during the pregnancy as a result of the pregnancy. And so it usually is because the placenta, like the baby, has its own unique makeup. And sometimes it has a hormonal profile that will, especially in the around the 24 to 28 week zone, is going to start making your sugars go high. And so those are usually who we call a gestational diabetic. We have moms who may have not known they were diabetic, and then we do early screenings on them, and they screen positive. And there's a high chance that they already had some level of insulin resistance or diabetes before the pregnancy they just didn't know about. So that's a little bit of a different category. But if it's around the late second trimester, they get their glucose screening and they find out they're gestational diabetic, then that's who we call a gestational diabetic, that those high sugars are most likely due to the, you know, just how their pregnancy is made. And the most important thing about that is to know that that it is something that's manageable. It's annoying. I told them, I acknowledge that it's annoying. But it is something where you work really closely with the team to make some lifestyle choices, if that, you know, to see if you can, you know, get those sugars in control. Only 30% of women are going to be able to do that. And it's not because of their choices. Again, it's what their placenta is pushing into their bloodstream. 70% of women are going to end up needing on medication, and the medication we usually recommend is insulin, because it doesn't cross the placenta.
Yeah, you read my mind. I was just gonna that part I've went through, so I'm like, yeah, there's no metformin when you go from that particular aspect to that aspect. They have to give you something that's natural to the body. So yeah. So the question that do doctors. When it comes to gestational diabetes, if a woman has gestational diabetes when she's pregnant, does that mean she's going to have diabetes when she delivers, or does it stay? Does it come? Is it like an unwanted house guest? Does it come and stay for just a short period, or does it come and say, I'm moving in with you?
No, it depends. It really depends. Sometimes, as I said, is that women already had some baseline insulin resistance. There's a 50% lifetime risk of developing diabetes if you've been diagnosed with gestational diabetes. So what I always tell patients is that make sure that after you deliver, right now we have a program, and this is what all the country does, is that at 6 weeks you come back, you take another glucose test, and if you test in positive, then you go see an endocrinologist, and if you test a negative, then we always say just watch it, see how it's going, go to your primary care. But this strategy is not really great, because most people at 6 weeks are still dealing with a newborn and still dealing with a baby, and they often don't show up for that test. And so many women will not get that test, get pregnant again, and lo and behold, they have diabetes again. And so there's some question whether they have had diabetes all along.
So it's important and imperative that in all the things that you're going on, when you're not getting any sleep and feeding hours, or somebody's hungry, and if they're not hungry, if they're not crying for them, they're hungry, they're crying because they want a clean diaper, because the only person that likes change is a wet baby. So you definitely want to make sure that you get yourself back to those particular appointments to be able to ensure that you're the healthiest you can be for that little one who's now depending upon you.
That's true. But I will say that I will put a little bit of the onus on how we've developed the system, and that we are trying to, I think this is an area of research right now, an area of concern, that we don't support moms, especially, when they have in that newborn period as well, to really make sure that they are taking care of themselves. And I think that we're trying to come up with better solutions. I think it's somewhat unreasonable to expect moms to sometimes always show up for that 6 week appointment, given all the stresses they're going through. And I think that the fact that they are so stressed that they can't make it to those appointments speaks to not only the healthcare community not really giving them a good solution to that, but also our society that really doesn't support them in a way that they can take care of themselves.
So how critical is it that a woman definitely makes sure that she gets those things? Because we look at postpartum depression, all those other things that can happen, and are those things that are checked during that 6 week period that the woman, or is that something that, a lot of women, you look at Serena Williams' story, she said she knew something was off and she kept telling her doctor, but it took a whole lot for her to finally get care and treatment for that.
Yeah, well, she had a pulmonary embolism, which is like life-threatening, and I think everybody listens to that story and is just shocked. I will tell you that if a patient tells me something is up, and even if I can't find a concrete reason of why something is up, I still believe something is up. We have certain tests, but these tests don't tell us the whole story sometimes. And so so that's one thing. But the other thing is that I do think that the healthcare community probably could do better in listening to patients and, you know, prioritizing what they're experiencing. We have like a very protocolized way of managing disease that sometimes we forget that if somebody is experiencing something and feeling something, it doesn't mean, and if it doesn't fit that profile, it doesn't mean that they're not experiencing it. You know, so I think it's really important that we do listen to our mothers and our birthing people. But the other thing is that with depression, some of that is that there is some biological component to that. You're going through so much change. You know, you're, as we talked about, you're changing diapers all the time, not getting great sleep. But some of it is also that we don't live, again, in an infrastructure that really supports families in that critical period, because we often have to, often they have to take time off work. Often it's unpaid. It adds more stress to the family. You know, we don't give paid leave to mothers. We don't give them really support. And I think that's something we have to look to what other countries do to figure out what they're doing better. Because as much as they won't necessarily eradicate postpartum depression, I think there's a lot of things that we can do easily in supporting mothers and birthing peoples in that period of time after the delivery so that we can at least reduce it.
What resources are available in Kansas City metropolitan area through University Health for women who may be having a difficult pregnancy, one, but then also after the pregnancy to be able to help them get back to that established new normal?
Oh, yeah. That's a great question. Well, I think that if they ever are overwhelmed with complications of pregnancy, they should, if they haven't talked to a high-risk doctor, they should talk to a high-risk doctor. And they should also know that if they ever encounter a doctor that they feel is not necessarily a good fit for them or is not listening to them, there's always another doctor. And nobody takes this personally, because we know that sometimes it is a matter of a good fit. So they should know that we're here, University Health is here to serve the patients. You know, they're not here to make us, you know, feel good about ourselves or, you know, listen to us. We're here to listen to them and take care of them. There's an incredible, one thing that University Health did a really great job and has been a pioneer is incorporating a mental health and wellness component to the perinatal care that we give. A lot of this has been, you know, spearheaded by physicians that were here a long time ago, but it has been further developed by Dr. Tiffany Ruffin and Dr. Jarvis, who's a psychiatrist. They actually sit in my perinatal clinic, and they provide a lot of support to the patients. And I think right now there's also a group prenatal care. It's part of a study that's being done in conjunction with WashU and Dr. Tracy Johnson and I, but Dr. Tracy Johnson is the local lead for that project. And group prenatal care is something that is really game changing in terms of giving moms the support they need. The other thing is that there's some great clinics, some great primary care clinics to help mothers get their health in order, get, you know, their blood pressure in order, or even help with obesity. Some really wonderful obesity clinics that even many of the staff I know actually go to. So if they have any problems even after the pregnancy, there's some great resources even in the primary care clinics to help them sort of deal with them.
What are some of the tests that doctors run while the mom is still pregnant on the baby to make sure that the baby is developing normally and that everything is going good with the baby?
Oh, yes. Well, so we do the prenatal labs to make sure everything is okay initially, and then usually around the early second trimester, we offer tests to see if you want to look at the risk for Down syndrome or not, to also look at the risk for other chromosomal problems that can happen with the baby. For those tests, I always say that's a personal decision for the patient. It's really what you're going to do with that information. And then around the end of the second trimester, early third trimester, we do the diabetic screening. If they already have diabetes or they're high risk for it, we do that a little bit earlier. We also check we also look for other things like, you know, make sure they don't have any sort of latent syphilis that they didn't know about. You know, we test for HIV as well. You know, we make sure that they're not anemic. It's very common for your hemoglobin to go down when you're pregnant, but you don't want it to go down too much. So we keep a close eye on that as well.
So at what point in her pregnancy should the woman get her first ultrasound?
That's a great question, too, in their first trimester. The earlier you get the ultrasound, the more we know what your dating is like. That when we say dating, that means we know exactly how far along you are, because there's certain margin of error with that. And it can get really confusing, because every time you get an ultrasound, you're going to be, we'll say like, oh, this baby measures about this, you know, much, and the due date is this. But the due date is really your first ultrasound or your last menstrual period. And the earlier that ultrasound is, you know, especially if it's around 8 weeks, that's the ideal. That's the ideal dating. So we have a better, we have the best idea of how far along you are.
So what are some signs and symptoms? Because some of them, you read the stories that they've right. never known they were pregnant. What are some signs and symptoms that you may be pregnant? Even though, as much as you keep saying no, somebody else is saying, I'll be here in 9 months. So you hear the story on the lady that she went to the hospital uh-huh. and 24 hours later, she's got a baby. And I'm like, how do you not know yeah. 9 months that you go through and you don't have a baby?
Well, that's also a complex question. Well, first, I mean, there's a funny story about that. I had a friend who once said on Facebook that she thought, like, she was living in Washington, D.C., and she was saying, like, how something was stinking. Like, the train system there was, like, she was just like, it's so smelly. And I wrote her back. I said, are you pregnant? And she was like, wow, you're really good at your job. But it's sometimes things like that. You're just like, suddenly everything is really smelling not so great. You're kind of feeling queasy, nauseous. You just notice something's a little bit off about your body, and lo and behold, you'll find out you're pregnant. And I think people do have a good intuition about their bodies. So if you feel that something is up, I think that when people are term and they didn't know they were pregnant, there's a little bit of maybe this is not knowing their full story, but I think there's also some level of not knowing or not being attuned to their body, or knowing that there's a pregnancy and not really acknowledging it due to fear. And that I think is a bigger issue. Like, why do women feel fear to say that they're pregnant? And again, I think that speaks to, again, a society that sometimes would, where they feel that the society might lash out against them for being pregnant.
So Dr. Malik, what, if somebody wanted to get a hold of you at University Health mm-hmm. Center, how will they get a hold of you or your office to make an appointment?
Well, they can always call. I have two offices. So I work in downtown. I also work in Lee Summit. And in fact, my Lee Summit clinic is a private clinic. I'm only there on Tuesdays. But they could call either of those offices to request me. And I'm also around. I'm like here and there. So if they run into me on the street, they can also just let me know.
So as we close out, do you have any ideas or things or suggestions you would like to leave with women who either may be pregnant or may be looking at getting pregnant?
Sure. Well, what I would say is that it should be something that they want. It should be something that we should celebrate. And even if it's high risk, this is something where they should not never feel that they're doing it alone or that there's something wrong with them. You know, we all have a different makeup. We all have things that are, you know, some challenges, our own set of challenges. And sometimes pregnancy can make everything feel a little bit more overwhelming. And so they should know that there's a team ready to help them and serve them and you know, be there for them the best they can. You know, I definitely feel that way about anybody who's pregnant.
So I definitely want to thank Leslie Carto at University Health for doing sure. this. And she texted me in a question. And I know you will at Children's Mercy also. Does being an adolescent or a teen make a pregnancy high risk?
It just the same way being older does. You know, you're just at slightly higher risk for all those things that we talked about, high blood pressure, having preeclampsia. But at the same time, I want to emphasize that it's something that we will be there for the patient. Like, they should not have joy from it just because they're a teenage pregnancy.
So we've had our political, we've had our financial. So now next week we're going to have another episode. I'm trying to look at working with one of the doctors, University Health, because folks, Missouri has sold a record amount of cannabis since they've opened up. And cannabis is actually impacting one segment of our community a lot more, our seniors. So That's what we're going to try to work on next week, but we never in Cowtown Conversations without our Community Minute. I definitely want to thank Dr. Malik for being our guest today. And one of our original KKFI DJs is going to host his final show next week, Groovy Grant Hopkins, host of OG's Hangout on Wednesdays from 3 to 6. He has been on the air here at KKFI for over 30 years, so tune in this Wednesday at 3 p.m. for his final episode of OG's Hangout. Give him a call. Let him know how you've loved his show, if you were a listener, and the different things he's been here for so long. Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority is hosting their financial literacy series called Get Your Mind and Your Money Right, and is hosted by financial advisor H. David Whalen. The next session will be May the 9th, and it'll be on credit, debt, and investing. It will be held at Ellison Hall, which is located at 4810 Sterling Avenue. Right, if you, the quick trip right there, Sterling and 40 Highway, right behind the Wash House right there. They've got a building that's right there. And so it's going to be starting at 6 p.m. If you need more information, you can call Gwen Goins at 765-274-6366 or Vanita Siffel at 816-213-6366. So for Cowtown Conversations, been your host, Joseph Jackson, saying have a great day, stay safe, and stay tuned for Signal to Noise.